You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 308.
On today's show, we talk about our visit to the Yukon Beringia Interpretive Center.
Let's dig a little deeper. Don't get buried nice.
Into the permafrost.
There's a lot of cool stuff in there.
There is.
Welcome to the show.
Hello.
All right. I always say this when I think we're in a noisy environment, but we end up getting it all out and you can't hear anything.
Yes, but this is particularly noisy. We have a lot of ambient noise going on because we're sitting outside and enjoying the heat wave. Fairbanks.
We are in our Kwikset clam out behind our RV, and because we're behind the RV, we're secluded that way in our site, but this is a very forested RV park.
So pretty. I've got trees like 360 around me. Not quite 360 because the RV is there. Almost all the way around. It's so pretty here.
Yeah, we're in Fairbanks, Alaska. We just made it there. We made it to Fairbanks and
yesterday.
And this is our 50th state for both of us.
Yes, we did it.
We've seen all 50 states.
We've touched all 50 states. I wouldn't say we've spent generous amounts of time in some of them.
Do it. Doesn't matter.
We've driven through them and spent a night here and there. So we've spent time in all 50 states, but not time.
There are certain metrics for having been to all 50 states.
Yeah, airports don't count.
None of ours were airports.
No.
So we were in all 50 states. Yes. Some of the eastern states are you really do just drive through them, but...
Yeah, for example, Rhode Island last year, we really just
We did some stuff in Rhode Island.
We did. We went to Newport. We spent a day walking around and experiencing the town and cities. Yeah.
So, anyway we're here in Fairbanks, and historically speaking, for future archaeologists that are trying to look at the ice cores up here, because there aren't any right now, because today or tomorrow, one of the 2 days, is the first ever... Since they've been recording them, obviously this could have happened before, probably has, but this is the first ever heat advisory in Alaska since they started recording heat advisories
so
in Alaska.
So crazy, right?
Yeah, we're in Alaska, people.
And let's just put this in perspective. A heat advisory for Fairbanks is low 80s. 82 was the high today. I think 84 and maybe 85 are the highs over the next couple of days. That's what a heat wave up here is.
Yeah. So I got my hair cut today and... I was talking to the guy about what we were doing, and he was born and raised in Anchorage, but then they moved to Arizona for a while, and he opened a barbershop there, but it was right at the beginning of COVID, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, he was like, I lived in Arizona, Phoenix area for 5 years, and then they go issue a heat advisory up here. These people don't know what
heat
is.
They don't even know. I'm from North Carolina.
Yeah.
This is not. This, for you, having grown up in Washington, would be a heat wave in Washington, too, practically.
Yeah, pretty much.
Some parts of Washington, maybe not all of it, but...
Who else would have thought this was a heat wave?
Oh, that's a good one. A woolly mammoth, perhaps? Oh,
he's like, I'm wearing a wool coat here.
You're so dumb. I love it.
So the megafauna and other mammals, and also the two-legged mammals that lived in this area up to starting around 14 to 20,000 possibly-ish years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all a little bit in contention, but...
Yep. And if you're wondering why we might be talking about that... We have turned our trip, and I know we've talked about this in past episodes, but we're trying to turn this trip to Alaska into a way to learn about the local history, prehistory, geography, geology, all of it. Because we're science nerds to the nth degree, right? We love all that stuff. When we were going through the White Horse area, we saw that there was a...
In the Yukon.
In the Yukon, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the Yukon in Canada, we saw that there was a place called the Yukon Beringia Interpretive Center. And we were like, that's cool. We like interpretive centers for sure. that's right in our wheelhouse.
I got an interpretation.
And then Beringia is something that obviously we know played a huge role in the population of this continent.
Yeah.
And we thought we'd stop by and see what they had to say about all that. So... Yeah, we did. And it was cool.
So, yes, Beringia. So for those that don't have any idea what we're talking about.
Yes.
Beringia is the name given to the landmass that partially doesn't exist anymore, although it did consist of basically all of Alaska and parts of the Yukon.
Yeah.
And parts of, what is that, Siberia over there in Russia?
Yeah. Yeah, it actually extended from the Lena River in Russia, which is way, way over in Russia if you look at it on a map. We're going to link to this cool article on the National Park Service, which is where we're getting a lot of the information that we're about to share. And it goes all the way over to the Mackenzie River in Canada, which I believe the Mackenzie River is like up into the Northwest Territory and then further over even than that. Maybe the Yukon as well. So. Yeah. But anyway, it's this gigantic swath of area.
Yeah. We're going to gloss over actual Beringia and like the deep dive of the history because we're going to go further into, further into it, I guess, on a future episode coming up here shortly.
But we were so inspired by the history and prehistory of the Yukon because it's such a cool place, really, that we have a whole plan for a future episode. So we'll talk about it some today, but not in depth.
We want to talk more broadly about what we learned at the Interpretive Center because it was really good.
Yeah.
I know most of you probably won't make it to Whitehorse ever.
Yeah.
And
it is out of the way.
It's out of the way. But just the broad depth of history that they covered and the range of topics that they covered and the things that we did and saw there, I thought it was, for a simple, kind of small museum / Interpretive Center, it was fairly well done.
It was so well done. Yeah. It had some really cool stuff in it. And we'll talk about this more, but we went on a tour. That was free. It was included with the admission, which was very reasonable. $6 Canadian a person, I think, or something like that.
Basically free.
Not basically free. You've already managed to piss the Canadians off one time this year. Could you please not?
It's basically flat up here and also free.
No, none of that is true. But yeah, so it was very reasonable price. Like such a great stopover. It was the middle of our drive day. Actually, it was near the end of our drive day because we weren't going much further past that. Yeah. So we just left early. We parked in their giant parking lot, which was great for RVs. And paid the $6 to get in and got this tour included with it and other things, which we'll talk about. And the guys there were so great. They were so passionate about the topic. They clearly were very knowledgeable and we just really enjoyed the tour. And we were the only two on the tour. So it was like our personal tour, which is always great when that happens too.
Yeah. So a little bit more about Beringia. This is what, when people hear about the land bridge.
Yeah, the Bering Land Bridge, Bering Strait.
Yeah, so you've got the Bering Straits, which is between Russia and Alaska right now. Right. You hear about the Bering Land Bridge, and that's literally the land that was exposed when the ice caps were at their highest extent, and some before and some after, obviously, when they were freezing, and the global sea levels decreased and exposed all this land.
Yeah.
So that happened, and there was a spit of land on the shortest distance between Russia and Alaska. Now, I can't stress this enough. Yes, they call that the land bridge. And in fact, there's a land bridge national park, Bering Land Bridge National Park, that we wanted to go to. It's out. It's actually really hard to get to the actual land bridge area.
Yeah.
If you're going to call it one specific area. Mm-hmm. But it's out near Nome, Alaska, and you have to actually fly there or, I guess, go over land somehow. But
I don't think you can drive. You can't drive to Nome.
You can't drive, but you could,
hike over. That would be
in the winter
lot.
They dog sled and snowmobile over
Snow machine. They call them snow machines up here.
Yeah. Yes, and they sit and they boat over and they fly most particularly.
And we could actually do like a flight scene tour from here in Fairbanks over to there, but it's like a 8-hour day or something like that, and we just were like, that is cheap. It's not cheap, and it's a lot of time in an airplane.
And we actually considered, because like Alaska Airlines and stuff, they fly out to Nome consistently, but the visitor center is actually closed right now.
Yeah, like we would touch down in Nome and then not actually be able to get to anywhere and then just turn around and come back. So it just didn't seem to make sense. But that stop us from talking about it, though.
So anyway, there is a land bridge that they call it, but it's not a...
It's not. Don't think of it as like a footpath.
No, it's not a footpath. And people didn't necessarily have to cross that one spot that was between right there. That probably would have been the area that was, I guess, exposed for the longest.
Correct. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But when you look at the area that was Beringia, this huge landmass that was exposed, it was gigantic. And when it was likely exposed for, I would have to say, hundreds, if not 1,000 years, people would have crossed and lived and done things completely on Beringia.
Yeah, for sure. This article that we found about it says that scientists believe that Beringia was at its widest point about 21,000 years ago.
Yeah.
But the last glacial maximum, which is when all the water was in the glaciers, so the sea level was lower, it started like 25,000 years ago. So that's like several thousand years of time where people would have been able to cross, not just right there between Alaska and Russia, but a whole like giant section of land was exposed. And sure, they would have been on a much longer section, but when you have thousands of years to cross it's a couple generations and you're done. You're over on the other side of the world, basically.
And this really should be one of our timelines episodes. But yeah. Now that I've said that, maybe we'll speak it into existence. But
maybe.
At the same time this was happening, of course, global sea levels decreased.
Right.
And at the same time this happened, you could have walked from England to France.
Yep.
Because there was a land bridge there.
Oh my gosh, I love this idea for timelines. I see where you're going now.
Yeah, and also, you couldn't quite get to Australia because of what they call a Wallace Line. It's a place that's just too deep to go, that's never exposed, unless we lose all the water.
Yeah.
But all of Southeast Asia was basically connected.
It was all connected, same time period.
Yeah, and there was a number of smaller, less significant areas, but those are the kind of the big ones where people used that time frame as populations are growing on the planet to basically populate some of these areas.
And I think another thing too, to think about is like, nobody sat there on the Russia side and looked over at the North America side and was like, we got to get over there.
Yeah.
We got to do this. Look at what could be over there.
Yeah.
It was just like this natural
bridges open.
Bridge wall. Yeah. No, it wasn't like it went up and down. It was just this like natural movement of people probably following resources.
Yeah.
And it organically happened over hundreds or thousands of years. That's how the move across would have taken place.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll talk about that a lot more in a future episode.
Yes.
And maybe another future episode, a timelines episode.
We're obsessed with all this up here right now. Yeah. So I feel like there's more stuff to come.
All right. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about our experiences at the Beringia Interpretive Center in Whitehorse, Yukon. Back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 308. Of the Archaeology Show. We're talking about Beringia, and more specifically the Beringia Interpretive Center in Whitehorse, Yukon, Canada.
Yes.
So many things to say.
Yeah.
And yeah, so we parked in the parking lot. There's like some wheelchair parking up front, but the nice thing about their main parking lot where we could park the RV was you have to walk through this little path to get there.
Yeah.
And they have these statues and things. Like, I'll tell you what, you're always like bear aware up there.
Yeah, you have to be.
Yeah, the first thing I noticed, like, off in the shadows with this little bear silhouette in the shadows, and, like, for just a millisecond, you're like, it's not real.
Yeah, I think they had representations of some of the extinct animals.
They had a giant beaver.
They had a giant beaver, which is one of the extinct megafauna from
the guy said it was almost true to life size, which was almost as big as you are.
Yes, it was. It felt
gigantic.
It felt a little too close in size to me.
Yes.
Like, I didn't want to encounter that in the wild, for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Good thing they're extinct.
That was pretty cool. So they kick you right into it with this nice little path. We didn't linger on the path too much because while it might be a heat advisory here 2 weeks ago in Whitehorse, it was bitterly cold and windy.
So cold and windy. Yeah.
So
it's crazy how the weather has changed for us.
Yeah. We're moving through it pretty quick.
Yeah, we are.
Incidentally, fun fact, sunset tonight, since we're less than a week to the solstice, is just after 12:40 a.m. and sunrise is about 3 a.m.
Yeah.
So that's new for us. That's crazy.
It has been really interesting. We have to pull the shades down at 10 o'clock or 9:30 or else we'll just like never mentally like transition into bedtime.
And the sun doesn't effectively set either. If you open the shades at 2 a.m., 1:30, it's not even dusk. It's just like like when the sun first goes down under the horizon.
Yeah.
It just dips under the horizon and kind of stays there and comes right back up a couple hours later.
It's light that you can just do stuff by. So it's disorienting.
I'm only mentioning that because obviously, when people were here, without the benefit of shelter and things like that, even when they did have shelter, certainly didn't have blackout shades.
Right.
And they just had to live through that. And
they might have had caves and stuff. But
sure, if they're in a cave.
It
more likely rock shelters. Because real caves that are deep are hard to find. But rock shelters, things like that. And maybe they tried to understand the fact that their own cycles were important to maintain. And they tried to get that sleep. But it could be that they just went to the point of exhaustion, too, and then slept as much as they could and then woke back up.
Yeah, because it was all the same, probably, especially in the trees. So, like, where we're parked right now in the woods is really interesting because you can imagine what life would be like if you were a native person living in the trees.
Yeah.
Primarily because it's been shady all day long. It's a little cloudy today. No, I don't know. The sky's kind of blue up there. Yeah. It's a little bit cloudy. Some clouds today. But it's so shaded in the trees that the light kind of stayed the same all day and all night. Like it hasn't changed much from this like ambient light level. So it's this kind of thing we'll never know, but I wonder what it was like for the body of somebody who lived 10,000 or 15,000 years ago, like how they handled that. It's crazy.
I know.
But they couldn't sleep all winter either. It's not like we're not a hibernating species. So I don't know.
No. Yeah. And that's the thing in the winter too. Like it would have been dark a lot without the benefit of, say, flashlights and having to use like some sort of alternative fire source or something for light. You had to still make your way around and figure out how to find food and stuff like that in the dark.
Yeah. I'm sure you did less, moved less, needed fewer calories, probably. But then again, you're cold all the time, and your body needs a lot of calories when you're cold. Gosh, I don't know. It's such a harsh lifestyle. Well,
this is one of the reasons some of the people on the coastal regions here fought so hard to, like when whaling and stuff like that was banned, they fought so hard to get it back because they subsist on whales so much.
Yeah.
Like, you go out and kill one whale. And the meat from that, the oil from the blubber, the other things that they get from it are so sustaining for their communities for such a long time.
Yeah.
They're just so used to that. And it still holds true today because they still have a hard time getting supplies.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
super important to the native lifestyle, basically. Right. Yeah. Right.
So anyway, we walk into the center and they've got this really cool, if you've ever heard of the concept of time as being a clock and the existence of humanity is like the last half a second.
Yep.
They've got this clock-like structure, this round structure that we actually have a picture of you standing in the middle of.
Oh, I took a video of it too. Yeah. We'll see if we can get that over to Tilly for posting. Yeah.
We'll get her some stuff and see what she puts online.
Yeah. But she's in charge.
She's in charge.
Yeah. We don't do anything.
We don't do that.
We're not part of that. Yeah. And we love her to be in charge.
I know. Yeah. But that's right in the entrance before you even get into the counter where you pay.
Yeah.
And so they hit you right up with some stuff and a map. And it's just so much to see right when you walk in. Yeah.
Yeah. It was so cool. And so you walk in through that room where they really lay out that geological timeline. So easy to see. So easy to digest. And then you walk from there, like you said, into where you pay. But then it's almost like, so I almost walked right past the pay booth because you just walk in with these big eyes and you're just looking at a wall of skulls directly ahead of you and all these other amazing fossils and displays and stuff on either side. Yeah. Like you said, it's just another example of a really good, I guess it's an interpretive center, not a museum, which is probably why it's so good. Yeah. They mean for you to learn rather than just see a collection of things.
Yeah, we got there at a good time where we had about maybe 15 minutes or so to just kind of look around on our own. Mm-hmm. And then they said a guided tour for free, which included, was starting. And again, like you said, it was like $6 Canadian or something to do this thing.
Yeah.
There was no discounts or anything. Didn't ask for like military or anything like that. That's
what it
was.
You're not part of the Canadian military. So you wouldn't get a Canadian military discount, would you?
I would not. No, nope. They probably don't recognize that. Anyway, so we just looked around a little bit on our own. And they have a lot of really cool cases and things like that where they've got some excavated finds, mammal fossils. Yeah, no human artifacts in the front
part
anyway.
Front. Yeah, this whole front section was primarily just about the extinct mammals that used to occupy Beringia, essentially.
Yeah. Yep. And then we didn't even get into the back part where they talk about some of the archaeological excavations, some of the mummified remains that have been found of animals.
Yes.
And then all this stuff. But we saw all that on the tour.
Yes.
Yeah, so let's talk about the tour.
Yeah, so the tour started with looking at, like we said, like a lot of the major extinct mammals.
Mm-hmm.
And the guide did a really good job of prompting us and asking questions and things. And that was really fun because he was having us guess at the differences between mammoths and mastodons, who both occupied North America. And I think at different time periods, though, right?
I think they were contemporaneous.
Were they
some
contemporaneous?
Cases,
yeah. Okay. And then also there's other animals who evolved in this area and then have since died out. Some went to other parts of the world and still live. So we can talk about all that. But it was just a cool display of fossils of all these different ones. And sometimes they put the modern ancestor next to it, too, so you can see the difference. Like the giant bear that used to be here.
Giant short-faced bear?
Yes. Yeah. And so the bones of that animal compared with the bones of a giant grizzly bear.
Yeah.
Three times the size. So amazingly huge. Can you imagine running into one of those when you're out just like trying to find something for dinner, right? And like you come across one of those guys.
Or it's like dark at 1 p.m.
Like in the middle of it. Hopefully they're hibernating and they weren't out at that time.
Hopefully they were hibernating.
Hopefully. But
stumble into one.
The variety of giant megafauna that lived in northern North America during the Pleistocene is amazing.
Yeah.
And they had examples of so many different things. And that was really cool.
It was really cool seeing the teeth. I've probably heard this before, but you don't really pay attention too much and mm-hmm. remember it. But like the difference between mammoth and mastodon, where mammoth had more flat teeth.
Yeah.
And you can see that immediately when you look at them.
Because they're grazers, right?
Because they're grazers.
Eating grass.
Grasses, things like that. Yeah. So they just gnaw and crunch the grass grains around.
Yeah.
And then the mastodon had more pointy teeth.
Yeah.
Because they could eat like branches and twigs and stuff like that and just rip stuff up.
Yep.
They were also bigger. Mastodons.
Yes. Yeah. And they were hairier. And their tusks were longer and straighter, whereas the mammoths curled up.
Yeah. So it definitely had some differences, both in the elephant genre.
Yeah.
But they, genre. What would it be? Species, not species. What am I trying to say?
Genus?
Genus,
or family? One of those? I'm not sure.
Yeah. Anyway, science.
We do it sometimes. Not right now, but.
Nope. Yeah. We got to see a lot of the guy went through case by case and was showing us different things. And I liked how he was quizzing us a little bit and trying to figure out what we knew and stuff.
I felt like
that.
I was in school a little bit though, so I always get like a little sweaty. Well, oh God, can I answer his question?
We were the only two on the tour as well.
There was a few people
that kind of dipped in and out, but it was the first start of the museum. Like when we came out of all this, the place was full.
Yes.
But when we first got there, it was right after they opened.
Yep.
And so there weren't that many people in.
Yeah, we timed it well as far as that goes for sure.
So anyway, that was really cool. And I guess we can talk about the camels and the horses.
Yeah, because the camels and horses which this is something I knew, but they'd had a really good dialogue around camels and horses. And something that a lot of people don't realize, I think, is that they actually originated in North America. They evolved here. And now that I'm not here anymore, obviously they are, but they were reintroduced by Europeans. Horses specifically were reintroduced to North America by Europeans. But they weren't here after the land bridge disappeared because they crossed the bridge. They went over to Siberia and into Asia and they just died out in North America. They weren't here anymore.
Yeah.
That's horses specifically. Camels were a little bit different. They also crossed over and went to Asia and then down into where we normally think of them coming from now, Africa and the Middle East and everything, or their ancestors. And then a sort of a branch of them also went down to South America. They just became warmer weather creatures, I guess, is what it seems like. And the ones that lived in North America also died out. But they started here, which is so crazy to think because it's like this full circle moment, right? Horses in particular, where they evolved here. They said, bye-bye. It's too cold. We're out of here. And then they moved over to the rest of the world, died out in North America, and then were brought back by Europeans. And then became a super important part of a lot of the native communities in North America. So very interesting.
See those first horse descendants getting off the boats in North America and go, wait, where are we again? Right. Son of a... we weren't supposed to be back here.
Yeah. It's more like, oh, guys, if we'd just gone a little bit further south, we would have found the good place.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was really neat. It was really cool to be in that place where such pivotal species, because both horses and camels, horses probably more so because of their impact on the rest of the world.
Yeah.
But horses and camels have been so pivotal to the advance of human civilization.
So important. It's they've really, not companions in the way dogs are necessarily, but companions in a carrying stuff for humans, carrying humans, like just so important. And to know that they evolved here is really interesting. It's just so interesting to think about.
Yeah. And to think that, like down in Nevada and Reno, where we used to live and go back to a lot, there's still like wild horses all over the place.
Yes.
Because obviously horses get away from people and they just end up back in the wildlife. And then after a few generations,
they're wild again.
Basically wild again. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just crazy. Yep. Makes me wonder if camels would thrive if you brought them back. There are camels in captivity, of course, but there's no camels like on the landscape.
That's true. Not the way horses are for sure. I don't know. Yeah. Interesting thought.
I don't know.
Yep.
But anyway, let's take a break and talk about some of the last things that we saw in this place and one of our favorite activities that we did at the very end. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 308. And we're talking about the Beringia Interpretive Center. So that first big room that we went through was cool. And again, had a bunch of, the tour actually went over all the fossils and things like that, the big skull wall, as you said it was.
Yes.
They had a lot of other displays talking about the different time periods of when Brinji really would have looked like, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah.
Like 10, 12,000 years ago, mm-hmm. 125,000 years ago.
Yeah.
That was really neat. But after then, they've got another big hall where there's some really big displays. And we went in there next.
Yeah, they called it like the taxonomy area or whatever. And what they had going on there was some of it was taxonomy and some of it was like replicas of what these extinct species would look like. And they were full size. So they were what you might have encountered had you been in Beringia 10,000 years ago or whatever.
Yeah, because one of the first ones he showed us behind this glass case was the giant short-faced bear.
Yeah.
But I think what he said was they obviously don't have any giant short-faced bear to build that from.
Right.
But it was made from the fur, and I don't know what the interior they made of it was. Like, I don't think it's like bones and things.
Oh,
like,
no.
So it's probably like some sort of model or something like that. But the fur, he said it took like several grizzly bears that they used to make out of that.
Like three or four.
A number that was higher than I expected.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's not as big as it would have been, too, because they just simply, like, it
didn't
couldn't.
Have the space.
It would have been too big.
Yeah. So
it's like a smaller version of what the giant short-faced bear would have looked like. But yeah.
Yeah.
But then they also had a yak thing, too, or a muskox.
Muskox was cool.
Yeah, they had a muskox.
Yeah, which are still here.
They are still here. Yeah, yeah. That's one that made it through all of the crazy melting and stuff with the glaciers. And
yeah, this muskox is in the wild, much further north than from where we're at and where we were in the Yukon.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, they but needed to be cold.
It was really cool because we're talking about how they were able to survive because their fur is so warm.
Yeah.
And as a knitter, I knew that because there's a couple brands of yarn out in the world that are like muskox yarn. Mm-hmm. And it is incredibly warm from what I hear. I've never purchased it. And the reason for that is because it is insanely expensive. Like you would probably have to spend hundreds of dollars just to get enough yarn to knit a scarf.
Yeah.
Which that's just crazy. That's even more than cashmere, right? Yeah. So anyway, but it's so warm and so soft and like amazing fiber. And it's what kept their bodies warm all through the crazy cold northern winters. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was a few of those displays, but there was also the next thing that we saw were some of the mummified remains that were found.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
that
just
was one of my favorites.
The whole arid nature of the area with the permafrost and things like that that developed, it caused some animals that have been found and recovered to have mummified remains. Sometimes they're all like flattened out and it's just the skin that's
I think we saw a horse that was basically just like a skin.
Everything else was basically gone.
Yeah, it's like it just collapsed and that was all that was left of it. But there was also a baby wolf, I think it was.
Yep.
So cute and so sad too, but so cute. And the reason they think it's so well preserved is because he was probably sleeping against the wall of a cave in his den.
Yeah.
And the den collapsed and it immediately he would have died, or she. I think it was a girl actually.
I can't remember.
Immediately she would have died. And then her body was just preserved under the remains of the wall that fell on top of her. Yeah.
Yeah.
So cute though.
I know.
So well preserved.
Yeah. And then the next thing they had was a big display of basically a recreation of Bluefish Caves, which is up near Whitehorse, basically, up in the Yukon.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the oldest human occupation areas in North America.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we should and probably will talk about Bluefish Caves on a future episode.
But yes.
They had a really good diorama sort of thing, the like almost life-size of a section of Bluefish Cave in the area there.
Yeah, and it was not just about the people that would have occupied it, but also about the excavation itself, which is always really cool to hear just how people did the excavation, how they approached it, what they found, where it was in the cave and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So they did a really good job of sort of visualizing that in an exhibit.
Yeah.
It's really neat.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Yeah.
Yep. And then they had to go around the corner from there. I really liked the sort of side miniature cutout, like a profile of Bluefish Cave, because they went through a lot of trouble to put like miniature tools and things like that in there.
They had a plumb bob and like a spool of the rope that you always use to tie up your unit and stuff like that. Yeah,
it was well done. Somebody put a lot of work into that.
Yeah, did you get pictures of that?
Yeah, I think I did.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah, and there was a big model of a step bison on wheels, which was neat. So
yeah,
that was cool. And then we did the obligatory movie.
Yeah.
There was, it was like a 15 minutes or so short film that was actually pretty well done.
It was good.
You know, to see what was going on there.
It was a good movie. All right. We love a good movie because even It's the great part about movies is that if you don't have a lot of time, like this tour actually did take quite a bit of time, mm-hmm. which we had the time, so we were fine with it.
Yeah, it was a couple hours.
Yeah, but the movie would have given you a lot of the same information, but in 20 minutes, if that's all the time you have.
Yeah.
Love a good park movie.
And then when the movie is over, they came in up on the little stage there and said, okay, now follow us outside if you want to see a demonstration of an atlatl.
And we were like,
yes.
What?
I know.
Yes, please.
I actually thought it was just going to be them showing how it works.
Yes. Yeah.
So if you know what an atlatl is, look it up. It's A-T-L-A-T-L. And basically the atlatl is actually just like a wooden paddle that's maybe a couple feet long.
Mm-hmm.
That's really all the atlatl is. The thing that you throw, it can be called a dart. It can be called like a spear kind of thing. A spear is technically like a thing you throw with your hands because darts are what you throw.
Yeah.
But they're as long as a spear, typically.
He had a whole like bunch of them ready to go for us to try because we all got to try it out, right?
Yeah.
After he showed us how it worked. And he was purposely pulling out ones that were about the height of the person who was going to try it. So I guess the goal is for it to be your height or just a little bit less than you.
Yeah.
So much longer than like an arrow for a bow, essentially.
Yeah.
But it does look like that when you think about it, because it's got the feather on the one end
mm-hmm.
and then some sort of tip on the other end.
Yeah, atlatls in the hierarchy of weaponry basically predates the bow and postdates the spear.
Yeah.
Because they were trying to kill these pretty dangerous animals.
Yeah.
And going up to them and trying to stab them was pretty hard.
Yeah.
Chances are you were going to die.
Yeah.
And so they started chucking spears at them.
Yeah.
And that was easier, but still sometimes the hides and just getting through some of these Ice Age megafauna was really hard. So you needed something with a lot more force.
Yeah. And like you might be doing it with 10 of your family members, but it was dangerous and people would die. And so over time, they just created a new and better method.
Yeah. So the atlatl is basically like a set of paddle that's about the size of your forearm, maybe longer, of course, a little bit. But you basically use that to hold the end of the dart, and then you use the atlatl to, like, I'm doing it with my hand, like you can see me. But you're basically propelling it a lot faster. Think of it like a lever. Yeah. You're using the atlatl paddle as a lever to basically just extend the length of your arm, essentially. So you've got an arm that's about 2 feet longer.
Yeah.
And it's, think of a pitcher doing a baseball. If they had a longer arm, you get a longer windup and you can just go faster.
And that's what this more did. Power. Yeah.
Yeah. So you could go farther, but also if you were closer, it had a lot more force and speed to it.
Yeah, for sure.
So
that was a game changer as far as bringing down these large megafauna. Early humans, early people in this part of the world would definitely be hunting mammoths and mastodons and all the other large animals. Not bears so much, because I don't think that humans ate bears that much, but the other large animals they definitely did. So mm-hmm. And having an atlatl to really propel something through that thick skin, thick fur would have been really helpful.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
Yeah.
So when he was done demonstrating how it was done, he's all right. Who wants to go? And
who was first? Who do you think would have been first?
Was I actually the first one?
Yeah,
I was the first
one.
Yeah, wasn't I?
Of course it was you. You're always the first.
I wanted to do it. I didn't care. I was going to set the example. And whether that example was throwing it straight into the dirt or throwing it over the hill, I wasn't sure. Because I'd never thrown one before. Yeah. And
you even own one, but you never threw it because you were afraid of breaking it.
This one.
Yeah.
And it was given to me.
Yeah.
And I was just like, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it was really cool. And I didn't even, I think, come close to the target I was aiming for, because they had these like little silhouettes of animal targets set up in the distance. Mm-hmm. And I was aiming for one that was probably, if I had to guess, maybe 60, 70 feet away, because
mm-hmm.
I knew there was some force to it. I didn't want to do one of the closer ones. Mm-hmm. So I was like, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to shoot for one further away. And I ended up well beyond it.
Yeah, you way overshot it.
I way overshot it, because I wasn't sure, not having ever done one before,
mm-hmm.
I wasn't sure what kind of power I was going to get out of it. But the cool thing that I thought about my throw was it was basically straight and correct. And I feel like with a little bit of practice, you could get it down.
You could get good. Yeah.
And also these didn't have point tips on them. They just had like a rubber stopper that you find at the end of a cane or something like that on them, just for safety.
Yeah.
You could still stick them in the ground. The guy who was doing the demo did.
Yeah.
Because it was softer ground out there. But
mm-hmm.
So that probably affected the arrow just a little bit. But it was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was really fun. Cool.
How was your throw?
My throw was fine. I don't know what you're talking about. No, know. I'm not good at throwing things. I'm sorry to be a stereotypical girl, but I have never been good at that kind of stuff. But I gave it a shot. And
no, your throw didn't. I mean, honestly, it didn't go that far. But
no, it didn't go very far.
It was a good toss, like with practice.
Yeah.
That wouldn't have been bad.
And I think I released too late, which is why it didn't.
It nosedive?
Down rather than straight.
That's the thing, is releasing it like the top of the arc. And if you don't do that, it'll just tank.
Yeah. We didn't really talk about how you're holding it, but it's really interesting. You pick up, you've got the paddle in your hands, right? And he has you put the dart point down into the ground. And then you've got the atlatl in your hand, and there's these two leather straps on it. And you put your thumb and your first finger through the two leather straps, and then you hold it with, you hold the atlatl with the rest of your hand, but then your two fingers, your thumb and finger, are holding on to the dart.
Yeah.
The shaft of the dart. And you also, you've got the end of the dart hooked into the back of the atlatl too.
Yeah, the atlatl's got a little hook on it.
Yeah. So you have to get the balance right on that.
Yeah.
And I'm not really sure I had it balanced exactly the right way with, like, where your hand is supposed to be and what you're holding at what moment. But whatever. It was fine. It was fun. And then when you go back to throw it, you have to release at the right time, too, to make sure that you're getting the right direction, the right force on it.
Yeah.
Definitely would take some practice, but I don't think it would be that hard to get really good at it, especially if your livelihood depended on it.
Right.
And especially if you were doing it all the time, every day, hunting. So I'm sure these prehistoric peoples were amazing at it.
I would love to have seen a team of people that knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
Take down and hunt a big animal.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah.
That would have been
cool. That would be so cool to see. Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. That was a little bit about the Beringia Interpretive Center in Yukon, the Whitehorse in the Yukon. Whitehorse is the biggest city in the Yukon. Might be like the capital of the Yukon province. I would imagine it is. I don't know what else would be.
It might be. I think Dawson City used to be it, and it moved to Whitehorse or something like that. But those are the two biggest cities in the Yukon. Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff to do up in the Yukon if you ever make it up that way. They got a big airport right there. Go fly.
Yes. Yeah.
The Interpretive Center is right there. So you can just fly in, go to the Interpretive Center, and then fly back out.
No. From there, you go to the Eclipse Hot Springs.
Oh, yes. We went
Eclipse Nordic Hot Springs, which, side note, we did, and it was top-notch.
Yeah.
Like,
it's basically a spa.
We weren't planning on staying in Whitehorse when we go back, but I think we might just for at least one night so that we can experience that again. It was amazing.
And we went to these hot springs, not to sidetrack too much, because we were staying there for a night. They have an RV park too.
They had an RV park. We needed to spend the night somewhere anyway.
I think we also have lodging.
They do. Yeah. But we were like, oh, we have to stay somewhere tonight. Why don't we stay at this like hot springs park and then we can go to the hot springs? Sound cool.
Yeah.
It was amazing. It was a spa.
I know. If you're staying there, I think it was like $60 Canadian or something. If we were, we got the discount because we were staying.
It was about
55 or
about
so. About
55 a person. Yeah.
Which might sound like a lot of money, but they had two different steam rooms, two different saunas, the room full of like hot beds that you could lay on. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that crowded. So we weren't fighting for things.
Nope.
A bunch of different pools, including the cold plunge pool outside.
Yep. Did not do that.
I did that several times.
Uh-huh.
And,
not for me.
Yep. And just a lot of really, you could just be there as long as you wanted.
Yeah.
At a cafe where you could go get stuff, get food if you wanted. And we were there with two of our friends. And I think I read on the website that most people spend about 3 hours a session. I'm just like being there. I'm like, I'll never spend like an hour tops.
Yeah.
I swear to God, we were there a good 3 hours.
Probably at least. Might have even been 4 hours. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we had an all day wristband too. So we could have gone back, but we decided not to.
Yeah. That just took it out of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, lots of cool things to do in the Whitehorse area.
Yeah.
Besides just going to hot springs. But definitely recommend that.
Yeah. All right, cool. Lots more coming up. Lots more we want to talk about.
Yeah.
And now that we're in Alaska, we're going to see a lot more cool things and talk about it too.
Yeah, so, for sure.
All right. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy, our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht, and our chief editor is Rachel Roden.
The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.